File 7. Often there are wives and children at home, and in many cases it happens that these become infected by such a way of living, especially if the husband is good to them and wants to do the best he can for them and loves them in his own way, according to his own lights. Then the week's earnings are spent in common at home within 2 or 3 days. The family eat and drink together as long as the money lasts, and at the end of the week they hunger together. Then the wife wanders about furtively in the neighbourhood, borrows a little, and runs up small debts with the shopkeepers in an effort to pull through the lean days towards the end of the week. They sit down together in the midday meal, with only meagre fare on the table, and often even nothing to eat. They wait for the coming payday, talking of it and making plans, and while they are thus hungry, they dream of the plenty that is to come. And so the little children become acquainted with misery in their early years. But the evil culminates when the husband goes his own way from the beginning of the week, and the wife protests, simply out of love for the children. Then there are quarrels and bad feeling, and the husband takes to drink, according as he becomes estranged from his wife. He now becomes drunk every Saturday. Fighting for her own existence and that of the children, the wife has to hound him along the road from the factory to the tavern in order to get a few shillings from him on payday. Then, when he finally comes home, maybe on the Sunday or the Monday, having parted with his last shillings and pence, pitiable scenes follow, scenes that cry out for God's mercy. I have had actual experience of all this in hundreds of cases. At first I was disgusted and indignant, but later on I came to recognize the whole tragedy of their misfortune and to understand the profound causes of it. They were the unhappy victims of evil circumstances. Housing and conditions were very bad at that time. The Vienna manual labourers lived in surroundings of appalling misery. I shudder even today when I think of the woeful dens in which people dwelt, the night shelters and the slums, and all the tenebrous spectacles of ordure, loathsome filth, and wickedness. What will happen one day when hordes of emancipated slaves come forth from these dens of misery to swoop down on their unsuspecting fellow men? For this other world does not think about such a possibility. They have allowed these things to go on without caring, and even without suspecting, in their total lack of instinctive understanding. But sooner or later, destiny will take its vengeance, unless it will have been appeased in time. Today, I fervidly thank Providence for having sent me to such a school. There, I could not refuse to take an interest in matters that did not please me. This school soon taught me a profound lesson. In order not to despair completely of the people among whom I then lived, I had to set on one side the outward appearances of their lives, and on the other the reasons why they had developed in that way. Then I could hear everything without discouragement, for those who emerged from all the misfortune and misery, from this filth and outward degradation, were not human beings as such, but rather lamentable results of lamentable laws. In my own life, similar hardships prevented me from giving way to a pitying sentimentality at the sight of these degraded products, which had finally resulted from the pressure of circumstances. No, the sentimental attitude would be the wrong one to adopt. Even in those days, I already saw that there was a twofold method by which alone it would be possible to bring about an amelioration of these conditions. This method is first to create better fundamental conditions of social developments by establishing a profound feeling for social responsibilities among the public. Second, to combine this feeling for social responsibilities with a ruthless determination to prune away all excrescences which are incapable of being improved. Just as nature concentrates its greatest attention not to the maintenance of what already exists, but on the selective breeding of offspring in order to carry on the species, so in human life also, it is less a matter of artificially improving the existing generation, which, owing to human characteristics, is impossible in 99 cases out of 100, and more a matter of securing from the very start a better road for future development. During my struggle for existence in Vienna, I perceived very clearly that the aim of all social activity must never be merely charitable relief, which is ridiculous and useless, but it must rather be a means to find a way of eliminating the fundamental deficiencies in our economic and cultural life, deficiencies which necessarily bring about the degradation of the individual, or at least lead him towards such degradation. The difficulty of employing every means, even the most drastic, to eradicate the hostility prevailing among the working classes towards the state is largely due to an attitude of uncertainty in deciding upon the inner motives and causes of this contemporary phenomenon. The grounds of this uncertainty are to be found exclusively in the sense of guilt which each individual feels for having permitted this tragedy of degradation. For that feeling paralyzes every effort at making a serious and firm decision to act. And thus, because the people whom it concerns are vacillating, they are timid and half-hearted in putting into effect even the measures which are indispensable for self-preservation. When the individual is no longer burdened with his own consciousness of blame in this regard, then, and only then, will he have that inner tranquillity and outer force to cut off drastically and ruthlessly all the parasite growth and root out the weeds. But because the Austrian state had almost no sense of social rights or social legislation, its inability to abolish these evil excrescences was manifest. I do not know what it was that appalled me most at that time, the economic misery of those who were then my companions, their crude customs and morals, or the low level of their intellectual culture. How often our bourgeois rises up in moral indignation on hearing from the mouth of some pitiable tramp that it is all the same to him whether he be a German or not, and that he will find himself at home wherever he can get enough to keep body and soul together. They protest sternly against such a lack of national pride, and strongly express their horror at such sentiments. But how many people really ask themselves why it is that their own sentiments are better? How many of them understand that their natural pride in being members of so favoured a nation arises from the innumerable succession of instances they have encountered which remind them of the greatness of the fatherland and the nation in all spheres of artistic and cultural life? How many of them realize that pride in the fatherland is largely dependent on knowledge of its greatness in all those spheres? Do our bourgeois circles ever think what a ridiculously meager share the people have in that knowledge, which is a necessary prerequisite for the feeling of pride in one's fatherland? It cannot be objected here that in other countries similar conditions exist, and that nevertheless the working classes in those countries have remained patriotic. Even if that were so, it would be no excuse for our negligent attitude. But it is not so. What we call chauvinistic education, in the case of the French people, for example, is only the excessive exaltation of the greatness of France in all spheres of culture, or, as the French say, civilization. The French boy is not educated on purely objective principles. Wherever the importance of the political and cultural greatness of his country is concerned, he is taught in the most subjective way that one can imagine. This education will always have to be confined to general ideas in a large perspective, and these ought to be deeply engraven by constant repetition, if necessary, on the memories and feelings of the people. In our case, however, we are not merely guilty of negative sins of omission, but also of positively perverting the little which some individuals had the luck to learn at school. The rats that poison our body politic gnaw from the hearts and memories of the broad masses even that little which distress and misery have left. Let the reader try to picture the following. There is a lodging in a cellar, and this lodging consists of two damp rooms. In these rooms, a workman and his family live, seven people in all. Let us assume that one of the children is a boy of 3 years. That is the age at which children first become conscious of the impressions which they receive. In the case of highly gifted people, traces of the impressions received in those early years last in the memory up to an advanced age. Now, the narrowness and congestion of those living quarters do not conduce to pleasant interrelations. Thus, quarrels and fits of mutual anger arise. These people can hardly be said to live with one another, but rather down on top of one another. The small misunderstandings which disappear of themselves in a home where there is enough space for people to go apart from one another for a while, here become the source of chronic disputes. As far as the children are concerned, the situation is tolerable from this point of view. In such conditions, they are constantly quarrelling with one another, but the quarrels are quickly and entirely forgotten. But when the parents fall out with one another, these daily bickerings often descend to rudeness such as cannot be adequately imagined. The results of such experiences must become apparent later on in the children. One must have practical experience of such a milieu, so as to be able to picture the state of affairs that arises from these mutual recriminations when the father physically assaults the mother and maltreats her in a fit of drunken rage. At the age of 6, the child can no longer ignore those sordid details which even an adult would find revolting. Infected with moral poison, bodily undernourished, and the poor little head filled with vermin, the young citizen goes to the primary school. With difficulty, he barely learns to read and write. There is no possibility of learning any lessons at home. Quite the contrary. The father and mother themselves talk before the children in the most disparaging way about the teacher and the school, and they are much more inclined to insult the teachers than to put their offspring across their knee and knock sound reason into him. What the little fellow hears at home does not tend to increase respect for his human surroundings. Here, nothing good is said of human nature as a whole, and every institution, from the school to the government, is reviled. Whether religion and morals are concerned, or the state and the social order, it is all the same. They are all scoffed at.